A change of location, a change of medium, but the creative expression remains constant. Stay tuned. Good afternoon. I am Stephen DeLuque, and you have tuned in to Ears on Art, a twice-monthly interview program produced at the studios of listener-supported KCBX Public Radio, serving the California Central Coast from Salinas to the north and south to Ventura. Today's guest is a relatively recent addition to the local art community. Jim Aproberts has been selected to do the cover for this year's Festival Mosaic program. Jim began his career as a stained glass artist in Southern California, but has now begun to express himself by painting. Co-host Krista Hewitt and I joined Jim Aproberts at his studio in San Luis Obispo.
Stephen and I are here in the studio of Jim Aproberts. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Krista. Good afternoon, Stephen. Welcome.
Hello, thank you.
Jim and I have known each other now for a decent amount of time, not long enough, because your sons were students at Cal Poly, bit of interaction, and then you started painting. Before you started painting, and where did the art and stuff start for you?
Gosh, I think it started when I was a kid. I always enjoyed creating things, making things, so I spent a lot of time working on projects, wood, painting, did a lot of craft work. When I was probably about 11, 12 years old, I talked my mom into taking me to a Standard Brands paint store.
I remember them.
Yeah, which was pretty much where you'd buy everything. They happened to sell oils and canvases and easels. And so I set up my first studio, so to speak. We had a large garage at the home where I grew up. And so I started painting when I was really young, you know, in 12-ish. And then I always liked drawing. Never pursued it in school. Never took an art class in high school. Never took an art class in college. Didn't go to college right out of high school. Kind of did the deferred start, you know, went to work. A good friend of mine was working with in stained glass down in Laguna Beach, and I had always been fascinated with stained glass, having been a kid who grew up in an Episcopal church, and a lot of Sundays where it was like spent staring at these windows, and then learning that this guy who had designed this little church that we went to, he was an architect, and he had actually designed the windows. And to me, that was always fascinating. So when I found out my friend was doing stained glass, I went and visited him for a very long day and took notes and said, hey, how do you do this? Where do you buy these materials and all of that? So I taught myself how to do stained glass, which for the next 20, 25 years, maybe 30 years, became a big part of my life. I rented a studio because I ran out of space in my one-room house. And the studio was just basically for me to kind of play around with glass and create things. And people would look in the window and go, can I come in and look at what you're doing? And then that led to commission work, which led to employees, which led to all kinds of good stuff. And, you know, so during that period of time, I ended up getting married, having kids. The studio grew. I hired a very good friend of mine who had a master's in fine art from UCLA, which was ironic, you know, that he was going to work for me. Then I hired a couple more people, and we ended up doing houses, churches, restaurants, public places, skylights, doors, windows, you name it. We did stained glass everywhere, all kinds of commission work. I was written up in the LA Times. And they had a magazine on Sundays called U Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And this U Magazine had a huge circulation. So on a Sunday morning, it was like, oh gosh, that person I was talking to wrote me up. And then on Monday, the phone just rang. It was nuts. So at that point, in order to keep the doors open, I started teaching stained glass classes in the shop. So we ended up selling retail. Typically sell glass, tools, supplies. And we rented another studio, larger space, and then another larger place. And then all of a sudden we had more employees. The commissions grew as a consequence. So I ended up selling retail, wholesale, doing custom work. We'd end up with 130 students taking classes per week at my shop. But then we couldn't build windows in that shop, so we rented another industrial space so we could work.
I was going to say, I would think that unless it was huge to begin with,
it wasn't. It was never huge. It was always like we managed to squeeze into places where we could get a good location. And at any rate, stained glass took me a long way. Didn't paint during that time. I did renderings for windows, and I designed windows. I had just a great team of people who worked with me, and that was a spoiler. You know, and I had great clients. We never advertised, and we just did great homes, everything from your next-door neighbor's bathroom window to Steven Spielberg's doors or his skylights at his studios at Amblin. And the studio was really a great experience as a non-art major.
When you're doing all this custom work, because I must admit a lot of stained glass has often relied on images that people put out in books for stained glass artists.
Right. We steered clear of that. Everything we did was original. We ended up with a lot of people who wanted Victoriana. We did it, but they were our designs. I did a lot of talking with people, you know, visit a home, what's going on in the house, how can I work with you to interpret your thoughts and ideas into the reality of stained glass and what you're going to live with daily. Typical customer situation would be somebody had heard about us, and then they would say, I'd like to see what you do. And I said, well, come by the shop and take a look at some renderings, take a look at some glass. And then I would talk with them about that. Then I get a sense of what their budget was. At that point, I would set up a time to come out and check out what was being done. A lot of times I worked on new homes. A lot of times I worked on remodels or just there's a window and we want to put something there. So I would get a sense of the architecture, the fabric of the house, so to speak, and then work from there. So everything was custom. It was great working with people and having the glass fit the architecture as opposed to here's a stained glass window out of a cookbook, you know, of glass design. Everything we did was really personalized. For example, my one studio was very close to Santa Anita Racetrack. And so I ended up with somehow jockeys coming in or trainers or people who owned horses. And so they wanted themes around horses. So I would actually do horses in stained glass. We also realized that in order to make a living, you had to compromise a lot of times. We did a lot of like, oh, am I really using these colors? Am I really going to do this? I hope they are going to want it when it's done because no one else is ever going to want this. I ended up going down to Laguna Beach and doing work in one home specifically that stands out in my mind. It was based on the Gamble House, Green and Green. I'm a fan of Green and Green, and when I heard I could work on their bungalow, I thought it was pretty cool. Well, their bungalow ended up being a 17,000 square foot bungalow.
Just what we all have, right?
Yeah. I think that violates the term, actually.
Yeah. But I ended up doing several windows in the home, and one of them was 250 square feet, which was, to my knowledge, one of the largest commissions in a residence that I know of. Just the design and fabrication of that was very challenging. The installation of it took three of us about 10 hours. It's still standing today. That was pretty cool.
That is pretty cool.
Yeah.
I mean, a 250 square foot window is, number one, heavy.
Well, yeah. It was all in sections. So each section could be, say, 6 square feet. And there was a wooden frame that it sat in. So those are called mullions. Mm-hmm. So the structure of each section was strong in and of itself. The overall piece was one big frame holding it up. That's the trick.
It's just that it's not only the artistic part of it, too. It's also the engineering that's involved with installations like that.
Yeah, it was a challenge, too, because you take a rendering that's like, you know, on a 12 by 18 piece of paper and then making that full size and making it work and then interpreting the colors correctly. And in that case, we used all opalescent glass. And just the glass alone was a challenge to make sure that we could get it all right.
We have talked with glass fusing folk who have a major issue about compatibility of glass.
Right.
I'm assuming with stained glass, there isn't quite the same thing, but is there still a structural element that you have to care about what kind of glass you're using together? Or is it not an issue at all?
We didn't have that issue. We had the issue in terms of thicknesses of glass, because I would use hand-blown glass from Europe or from the United States, and so the thickness of it could vary. So getting that to fit in the glass came, the channel, was a challenge sometimes. I became a glass addict. You know, we had samples in our windows at my studio where you could come in and actually look at 350 different little chips of glass, and we would have that all available. That came out of the fact that I had a retail business and a wholesale business, and that I could afford to spoil myself in terms of our studio with that. And so our palette was amazing. Bigger challenge to me was working out colors. Glass looks one way when there's no light coming through it. It looks another way when there's light coming through it. When you get the light coming through the glass, it changes altogether. And then two different types of glass next to each other, there's a halation effect. So that presents altogether another challenge.
Would you define that word?
Halation?
Yeah,
I think
it's
I don't think I made that word up. I think it's that two colors go together, or three or more, and as it's the light as it comes through the glass and what it creates. Also, there's the mood of the day changes the glass. If it's natural light or incandescent light, those were all factors. I was very fortunate. I couldn't have done what I did if I wasn't living where I did. I wouldn't have access to larger urban areas. I ended up with work that ended up in Arizona, Canada, Virginia, different places. So we weren't limited to Southern Cal. I sold my studio at a time when I really felt I had used up my time with it. It was becoming 7 days a week and 12 hours a day, and I had two young boys, and I was real fortunate that I was able to sell my studio, and a couple of my employees bought it. And then I had a covenant not to compete, and that kind of took me out of the market. Former employees now own their own studio. And I went to them and I said, hey, how about we work together and I'll be a designer and you be the fabricators. So I had a pretty good run at that too. Mm-hmm. I all of a sudden realized, gee, I don't need to be responsible for all of this. I don't need to deal with workman's compensation and landlords.
You get to do the fun stuff.
I got to do the fun stuff. And that was super cool because I got to, I had clients who were just great and would design up this work. My friends who were now had their own studio were my former employees who I had trained to do what they were doing, basically. They loved it, you know, because I would bring them work, and I loved it because I could design it up and they could do all the heavy lifting, so to speak, and then I would go out and install it, you know, and I would continue meeting with my clients, and so I did that for quite a while too.
The covenant was a geographical restriction?
Yes.
Okay.
It was a complete sale. And part of that was a covenant not to compete with them in a certain area and for a certain period of time. The covenant's up now.
Yeah. I had the same thing when I sold the bakery. It was that I was restricted geographically and a time period.
That was a good thing to do, truthfully, and I never wanted to go back. I never felt like I was in a competitive business. Mm-hmm. You know, I felt like we were just doing an art.
If you have just joined us, you are listening to Ears on Art, a program produced at the studios of listener-supported KCBX Public Radio, serving California's Central Coast. Today's guest is painter Jim App Roberts. Now, Chrissa Hewitt and I join him at his studio.
As we're sitting here in this studio, I thought my studio had quite a bit of stuff on the walls, but it's all different stuff. And in your case, it's all your work, your paintings. We've been talking about stained glass. Talk about style and other things. What kind of influences do you feel from the stained glass work?
The stained glass really pushed my use of color, most of all. I really learned about color. I never studied color. I worked with color. I couldn't tell you anything about color, truthfully.
Me neither. You can.
Yeah, I've studied color theory, yeah.
I can remember my sons at Cal Poly doing the color.
The gradients.
My gosh. To me, it's all intuitive. I think working with stained glass really pushed my feeling for color. I love color. What I do in terms of painting is I told one of my sons I zigzag from one thing to the next. I do a lot of series of work, and I don't realize I'm doing series, and all of a sudden, gosh, I'm doing that same thing again, you know? Or I don't paint to produce, to sell. That isn't why I paint. And I've had a pretty good run at that. I've been painting ever since I sold the shop. I've been in several shows. I've had a lot of individual shows, been in group shows. My work is kind of getting out there. I'm excited that people are starting to collect it. I've got people from different parts of the world who are interested right now. Social media has taken me to places I never thought possible. I didn't ever think I would do it, but I did the Facebook thing, and that led to 5,000 friends and 5,700 followers on my art page, and to selling work to people who viewed my work that way. I've sent work to Cape Cod, which doesn't seem like a place where my work would end up, especially.
Well, I don't know why I would make that presumption. I mean,
it's colorful.
And also, you need to brighten up those long winters.
I think that Stephen's right on the mark. Winters are a different thing, and so being able to know that you've got that ray of sunshine all the time. And in addition to color, what I'm noticing is a wonderful sense of pattern and what I'm going to make up a word maybe right now of segmentation. Is that a word?
Sounds good.
It sounds good. Anyway, just that sense that does feel like an influence from cutting up a whole lot of pieces of glass.
I think there are some pieces I do. There's a piece right over there in the corner that, to me, if I look at it, it feels like a patchwork. A G's band. Are you familiar with the quilt?
Yeah.
I wasn't familiar with that at all. And someone looked at that piece and said, G's Bend. And I looked up G's Bend and I thought, stained glass, as opposed to quilt. But several people have commented to me, because I think there's a way that I patchwork things together. I think what's cool about painting is you're not restricted as you are with cutting glass.
Correct.
If things can go together in different ways. So it's all a big experiment to me. I have a lot of themes I work with. Done a lot with Los Desaparecidos, Argentina and specifically. I have a show at Studios on the Park right now where I have a painting called Liberia that deals with migration. And a friend of mine is from Liberia. And long story short, I learned about the history of Liberia through her and when her parents were executed in a coup. There are themes that I work with that way. Living here, this landscape and these colors that we have in nature have influenced me greatly. I spend a lot of time in the Southwest. I'm drawn to that. Mexico, I have a lot of people who think, gee, Jim, are you Mexican? Are you from Mexico? I speak Spanish. So I get a lot of that. Painting is just, it's just fun, you know, to me. I don't know if you noticed this, the surfboard.
I have. I've been looking at the surfboard.
That was kind of cool. I was invited to be part of the Morro Bay Surfboard Art Festival, the premier one in 2014. Was very successful, raised money for Morro Bay in Bloom and Project Surf Camp. And then this year they did it again. But I really enjoyed it. As a matter of fact, I've gotten commission work as a consequence. So this was an old beat-up surfboard. It was no longer rideable. We were given boards to paint, and so it was kind of a recycling of them. And I would love to paint one that would be fiberglassed over and be brand new. That would be great. I'm a lifelong surfer, so to me, I could be drawn to that pretty much. I'm very excited about this year's Mosaic Festival.
You're doing the poster.
It's done. Bettina, who's the director, learned about my work, and so she came to my studio and visited, and we talked, and she said, I'd like you to paint for this year's Mosaic Festival. And I said, well, I'm not sure that my work will fit, you know. And she said, just paint something. So paint. So I painted a painting, and I didn't feel it worked. I was happy with the painting, but it didn't work.
Right.
And then I painted another painting, and I was not happy with it. And I gave Bettina a call, and I said, Bettina, I don't think this is working. She says, Jim, just feel the essence of what the Mosaic Festival is and what it means to you. And so I did that. You know, the feel of it to me is festive. You know, it's a festival.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And people. I mean, there's that sense of a whole bunch of folk all together, which is certainly about a festival.
And that's what I wanted to convey. And so I'm very honored and thrilled to be part of this. I'm so excited, you know, because of social media, and I do have a website, my work is starting to be followed in different parts of the world. Pretty amazing. I feel like very welcomed by San Luis Obispo in that regard.
you were talking about the struggle, for mm-hmm. lack of a better word, of getting this particular festival mosaic image put together. We found it kind of interesting over the years to have artists talk about those times when mm-hmm. things don't quite work, as opposed to the wonderful times when things just all fall together. So do you have,
I have
different
those.
Ways that you get through them?
Yeah, I just keep going. You know, I paint almost every day, and I feel very fortunate in that I have my studio's at my home now. I don't drive somewhere, and I've done that in the past, and that I can work late, I can work early, I can walk away from it, I can always leave it out, and I can work on two paintings at the same time. I've painted complete paintings and stepped back and gone, I need to start all over. I'm good with that. I've learned that if you're not satisfied, you should start over. You know, my standards are pretty high for myself, and I'm willing to make that investment. I was asked to be in this show up at Studios on the Park that deals with migrations, and the curator of the show came and visited my studio, and she saw one painting that I'd done, and it really resonated with her in terms of, this is the painting I want to have in the show. You know, honestly, I kind of think that sometimes, is it really done? And it's hard. I have other paintings that I'm not really completely sold on, and I'm sort of think I'll revisit them. I have several in here where one of my sons said to me, he said, Dad, don't sell or give them all away. Hold on to some of them because you won't know where you've been.
Very sage advice.
Mm-hmm. To me, our materials that we work with are very inexpensive compared to glass. Mm-hmm. A canvas, or sometimes I paint on wood, is not very expensive. I feel like I more than get my money's worth out of each canvas. I work with a lot of paint that most people would not want. I use Oops paint from paint stores that is like, you know, and somebody's paid $20 a gallon for it, or $25, and I've paid 25 cents because it wasn't the color they like. So I end up with a lot of paint where I kind of make my own colors. And I have my tools. I work with tools that are different than most painters would probably work with too.
Such as?
Well, I've got some masonry tools. They just seem to allow me to manipulate the paint in a way that I like to. And my brushes are beat. I just kill brushes. I love palette knives. You know, I love tools that people in different trades use. Tools are really important. When I worked with glass, I realized, you know, the better your tools are. And they have to fit you. People will say to me with my paintings, they'll say, how do you get the texture you get? And I love texture and I love color. But I think I work on the concept of a lot of layers. And this painting right over here, for example, has a lot of texture mm-hmm. to it. If you were to run your hand across it, it feels pretty rough. To me, that's in part because of the type of tools I use and the type of brushes.
Yeah, Lucian Freud used to use a lot of like sawdust and sand and things like that that he would put into his paints and build up these immense layers.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah. I just think that's really good stuff. I've never done that. I've kind of just used paint that's beyond its time, you know?
Well, Jim, then there's a whole other world to start exploring. Yeah. This is just terrific. In the couple of shows that I've attended, mm-hmm. I've been able to see a grouping of the work. What's fun about being in your studio is that it's a lot of different style, even all within the same style. So mm-hmm. a little bit of figurative, the landscapes. And I hadn't seen as much of that variety in the exhibits, because often we tend to theme those and say, okay, now I'm showing off, da-da-da-da-da.
Well, I really enjoy landscapes. I really enjoy.
That's obvious.
Yeah. And I, for example, this piece over here, you know, this is one of my Desaparecidos pieces. And I think when you look at it initially, you see a landscape. But if you look at it, I've got images in there that are, to me, my way of paying respect to los desaparecidos, you know, people who've disappeared in migration or disappeared because of things that politically were going on in different countries that were wrong. First, when I started doing this type of painting with the landscapes, I was really focused on Argentina and the 30,000 people who were lost during the 70s. And then my brain went to all of Latin America, then to the Mideast and to Asia, and the desaparecidos are around the world, you know. So this has been really an important thing for me in terms of how people have responded to it. The response from people, for example, in Argentina, who get what I'm doing. When all the stuff was going on in Afghanistan with the burqas mm-hmm. and the Taliban, and that impacted me greatly too. I painted amazing number, but I probably painted 200 paintings that dealt with that. And I painted them small. and I love what I've been able to do, I kind of get into it, you know, and it's the texture and the composition is I'm free to do. You know, it's just me, you know. And they have been just a great resource for me. But my wife and I were living in Shell Beach in a very small house. I don't know, what do we have, 800 square feet or something at the time. And we were kind of between houses. So I needed to scale down what I was doing. And book covers just worked. I understand when they go to recycle them, the glue doesn't break down. Mm-hmm. So they actually do go to the dump, as opposed to being paper recycled. So I would go to Goodwill, and for $5, I'd buy a box of books.
Mm-hmm. Off the covers, right?
Most of them. I found some pretty good books I didn't want to take apart, you know? But I would take off the covers and paint them, so they became canvases for me. That's the difference between what I do now and what I did when I did stained glass. I think stained glass was very commercial, and I had clients, and I had specific needs. And with painting, it's just what
it's all Jim.
It's all Jim. It's all what I want to express. So that's the fun of it. That's truly the fun of it. My son's mother-in-law was here last week, and she says, "Jim, you're one lucky man." And I said, "Carol, I think you're right. I am lucky. I get to do what I want to do, you know, and I'm having a good time at it."
We've been able to talk with a lot of people who have that sense, because where their creative life has taken them has been very fulfilling, and therefore they are feeling very fortunate.
I have a great line for you. About a month ago, the New Times did an article on me, and it was about my work with Los Desaparecidos, you know, and I had a show down in Pismo Beach at San Liege. The lady who wrote the article, she called me up after she'd interviewed me and been to the studio, and she said, "Jim, I forgot to get your age." I gave her my age, and so that's not a problem. Then I thought about it, and I called her back, and I said, "Riot, why do you need my age?" And she said, "Well, you're retired." And I said, "I'm retired? When did that happen? When did I retire? You know, retirement's not part of the deal here. I've got lifelong employment, you know. I work every day." The R word didn't work real well.
No.
Right.
You know,
artists never retire.
Artists never retire. Will either of you ever retire?
No, no, not in that sense.
No.
It's a very special gift.
Even though we're not retiring, I think that's a great note to end on, because it just sort of says it all. Thank you so much.
It's
been such a pleasure to be here.
It's been absolutely delightful, and your paintings are amazing.
Well, thank you, Stephen. I'm honored that both of you are here today. It's been really fun for me.
It's our pleasure.
Co-host Krista Hewitt and I would like to thank today's guest, Jim Approbert. Jim has a website where you can view images of his work. The site is www.jimapproberts.com. Jim Approberts is also exhibiting at Studios on the Park as part of the Migration Show in the Atrium Gallery. The show is up until January 31st. Studios on the Park is located at 1130 Pine Avenue between 11th and 12th Street in Paso Robles. Visit their website at studiosonthepark.org for hours of operation, upcoming events, and workshops. Tickets have gone on sale for the Arts Obispo Fundraising Ball. The event will take place on Saturday, March 12th in the ballroom at the Embassy Suites. For information, visit artsobispo.org or call 805-544-9251. You have been listening to Ears on Art, an interview program dedicated to the advancement and the exploration of the visual arts, produced at the studios of listener-supported public radio KCBX, located in San Luis Obispo on California's Central Coast. I am Stephen DeLuque, and for co-host Krista Hewitt, we thank you so very much for your support over the years.